This is CliffCentral.com.
I love you. Really do.
All right, that's a nice song. It's Java and DJ Maporisa and Ngempela. All right. So let's get into some news, shall we? Let's find out what's going on just before we embark on the weekend and stop caring about the news. Let's talk to Mabale Moloi and find out.
Okay. Do you remember how back in February?
No. Because I don't remember what I did last week.
Okay. Back in February, Kylie Jenner said that she was bored by Snapchat, right? Do you remember that whole thing?
Yep. Share price.
And then the share price dropped and Snapchat lost about $1.5 billion US dollars. Well, it's happened again.
What?
Yes. So Rihanna. Rihanna and her power have led to Snapchat shares plummeting yet again. Jeez. This is after the pop star urged fans yesterday to delete Snapchat after the app ran an ad making fun of her 2009 beating at the hands of then-boyfriend Chris Brown. So in the ad, the guys decided to play the online game Would You Rather. Mm-hmm. And they showed pictures of Rihanna and Chris Brown with the captions, Would you rather slap Rihanna or punch Chris Brown? So Rihanna...
Jesus, what a thing to ask.
Rihanna not feeling it, so she took to Instagram and said, Snapchat, I know you ain't my favorite app out there, but I'm just trying to figure out what point there was with this mess. She said, you spent money to animate something that would intentionally bring shame to domestic violence victims and made a joke of it. Shame on you. Throw the whole apology away. And then the shares just started to plummet. Hmm. Wow, guys.
But this isn't because the people who use Snapchat are shareholders.
No.
And that's the funny thing,
that's
right?
That's the funny thing is... It's not, I mean, look, subsequently, you know, people have now generated memes and kind of ran with Rihanna's Instagram post. So it's kind of spread from Instagram to Twitter and it's gone viral and all of that. But you're right. The people using these apps aren't the shareholders.
No,
so then why do these stocks plummet every time something like this happens?
I think because it's on such a precipice, like, you know, like with cryptocurrency, if you're not the coolest, you're out.
Hmm.
You kind of just watch your value decline. And if you're going to rely on whimsical, capricious millennials to build a value for your company, you're putting your life in the hands of people who really don't have a lot to be relied upon for. These are not people who you would say, you know, they're going to go to the AGM every year. Sit there and listen to balance sheet reports.
Also, when a Kylie...
Can we see the financials, please? No, I'd rather just Snapchat a picture of my genitals. If that's the basis for your business, you're in trouble.
When a Kylie Jenner or a Rihanna says, stop using Snapchat, I mean, who actually listens to them?
Who
listens to them and then really does stop using the app?
Right. You have to question who these rocket scientists are who are taking their cues from Kylie Jenner and Rihanna.
I think the bulk of the Snapchat users, which just assuming here, are tweens and teens who are heavily influenced by these people.
But do you think that they actually do stop using these apps just because their influencers said so? I don't think so.
That could be
They get entertained for a few days because the thing goes viral, but then afterwards they just keep it moving because, you know, they're addicted to these platforms as well.
Yeah, it's a little crack. You're right.
It is crack.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Yeah. It's like it's an addiction and then it dissipates.
Debatable. Because I know you
tell us.
Well, when I went through some of my fanatical periods, even as a teenager, I went balls to the wall. For example, when Michael Jackson died, I was part of those people who went out and I bought physical CD copies.
Yeah,
of
you were obsessed.
All of the CDs.
And right, you danced and you attended like...
Everything.
Right.
When the documentary came out, This Is It, after his death, I went and I watched that and I bought the DVD. And so I understand
you
what it's like.
You got caught up in the hype.
You are part of the mob. So when Rihanna, if I was obsessed with Rihanna and Rihanna says, I don't like Snapchat, I'm like, yes, girl. Done, delete, and let me carry on working to your music. That's the basis of being a fan. You are fanatical with things
well,
that
if
you
you're going to build a business on the back of that, you're going to be in some trouble quite often.
Yeah,
I think
true.
That's what Snapchat are learning.
Because for a lot of people, they go onto social media to follow the celebrities.
Mm. Yeah. Celebrities are still the most followed people on social media.
And a lot of people don't actually have friends. We keep forgetting this. So they're only on social media so they can look at celebs.
Yeah, I mean, that Kylie Jenner has 105 million followers on Snapchat. It's ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
That's
I agree. No, it's ridiculous.
That's almost double the size of South Africa.
Yes.
Can I play you something?
Just talk about, think of it that way.
Talk about ridiculous. I've got a clip for you.
Uh-huh.
Someone was in one of the portfolio committees in Parliament, and I've got a... You won't believe this unless I play it for you. So just give me a second and I'm going to get that together. Oh, by the way, while we're talking about things that are going on and stuff people are talking about, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that Liesl Gericke from Virgin Atlantic will be on the phone just now to tell us about them opening up another route. But, you know, we've been talking to Michael Otten, who's the CEO of OnePlan,
mm-hmm.
over the last couple of weeks. And we wanted to get a better understanding of the difference between health insurance and medical aid. Health insurance, which is what OnePlan offers, is the supply of a lump sum that covers hospital care. And if you're in an accident or you have an emergency or an operation, you'll be covered. This happened to my mom. She, on Sunday, was walking down some stairs on the last step, kind of like Hillary Clinton.
Aina.
My mom slipped and broke her, well, she dislocated and fractured her ankle badly. And yeah, she had to go to hospital and she had to have an operation on Monday night.
That
was a big thing. She was in hospital all day Tuesday.
Is she okay now?
Yeah, she's fine. She's back home and she's in this big moon boot. But I mean, this stuff happens to people, you know? Of course, I had to... my brother went to visit her in hospital. My sister went to visit her. I didn't because I don't like the hospital. So I had to go make up for that by... Yeah, going to visit at home. And, you know how it goes. I'm not good
You're
with
a delight, eh?
I don't like
hospitals. Well, that's weird, Gert, because we love them. All of us love them.
Some people do. Ben, there are people who love hospitals. Anyway, so my mom's better now. But again, this is where you need medical insurance, man. You walk into one of these hospitals and you don't have medical insurance, they will chase your broken ass out of there. They can't take on that responsibility. And then you're screwed because the longer you walk around with something broken or some dangerous medical situation, you know, you've got like spikes in blood sugar or you're having a panic attack along with the injury, whatever happens, you could be in major, major trouble. So we've been talking about this and then it suddenly hits home and reminded me, you've got to make sure you're covered because this plan from OnePlan also covers GP and dental visits and other medical needs based on the chosen plan. Imagine if you have a tooth problem, an emergency tooth problem, and you need to be somewhere that night and you need to go and sort it out that day, and you don't have any cover. You'll walk around with your tooth that's fallen out. Right?
Yeah.
Health insurance is based on your individual needs. It also offers cover that is unlikely to be covered by the medical aid, like accidental cover, injury to the body, or death cover. The term is self-explanatory. It's taking out insurance on your health. So if you want to find out more, and you might not think this applies to you, but please take my word for it. At some point, you're going to need to. OnePlan.co.za. You can SMS health to 31664, and OnePlan will call you back. That's health to 31664. It's as easy as that. Just do me a favor. Call them. Say, what do you offer? Even if you're already insured, you've already got medical aid, you've already got health insurance, call these guys up anyway. Find out what the difficult questions' answers are. How much do I have to pay? What will I be covered for? If you don't do this research yourself, you end up in a situation where it's not in your hands, you have no control, and you've been paying for something you didn't need, or worse, that you weren't covered for something you do need. That's health to 31664 and let them call you back. It's as easy as that. Oh, here's this clip. So this is in Parliament. This is in some portfolio committee. I don't know who the person in question is. I don't know what her designation is in Parliament, but listen to this. What she's trying to say is justice delayed is justice denied.
Oh, goodness.
Have you heard this clip? Have you heard this?
I have.
But fact of the matter is justice delayed is justice denied.
Jesus.
That's one. There we
don't,
go.
Just don't say anything.
No.
You know,
that was an extended play of what often happens to us on this show when our tongues get like wrapped up in our mouths and
the words
just won't come out. No, but that's what I'm saying with her. It's just an extended play of what sometimes happens to us on this show.
But fact of the matter is justice delayed is justice denied.
It's like her fucking brain kicked out at that moment. She just completely, like, things, wires got crossed.
And then she just went that one as she's ordering lunch.
No, I love it because after a while she recognizes,
it's not working out.
This is not working out.
So you know what I mean, though. Yeah, that's one.
That one.
Oh, I'm fine with that. I get you, mama. Yeah.
I love it.
But there's no, you know, sometimes English is not our mother nature. Sometimes.
All right. What else is going on in the news?
Well, I didn't know this, but apparently Durban has a rather serious sand problem.
What?
One of the issues here being that Durban is running out of sand.
Has Ray McCauley been stealing it again?
Ooh, I mean, you making all kinds of allegations that I cannot corroborate at this point, Gareth.
Allegations?
Do you see what I mean?
Justice delayed is justice.
That's exactly what I meant. So what used to be wide stretches of sand is now underwater, and beachside infrastructure, including a booster pump station at Derry Beach, is being destroyed. Coastal activists and regular beach users are
coastal activists?
You can be an activist of anything these days. It's allowed.
Standing up for the coast.
So coastal activists are blaming the Teguini municipality for the state of the beach.
Oh my God.
For the state of the beaches. But the municipality says, look, we're doing all we can in the face of climate change, and then also over mining of sand in the province. Who's mining sand?
Yes, who's?
And for what?
And the coastal
activists. For what?
You need sand to go into cement, don't you?
Coastal activist, but you don't take sand from the beach. They use river sand usually, and that gets mined. It gets mined inland. It's not something that happens on the beach. That's nonsense.
So one of the coastal activists is Johnny Vasilaros, and he says, basically, Durban is running out of sand, and the city apparently spent millions of rands building a new sand pumping station on the point, but that has now been rendered completely dysfunctional, so they can't use it.
Johnny sounds like he did it for the chicks. I don't hear a big deal here.
I didn't realize that this is an actual thing.
The end is nigh. Durban's running out of sand. Cape Town has no water. We've been killed by Poloni.
I agree. Let's listen to some songs people have sent us about Mabali.
You
like that, huh?
Yeah.
All right, a little bit of levity for the morning.
That's always interesting to hear.
Can I taste your juice? We got a problem with our WhatsApps this morning. I don't know what's happening here. Somebody says on Twitter, people won't delete Snapchat because people love seeing themselves in dumb filters. That's true.
This is true.
And that's the reason Snapchat's still popular. It's got good filters. People saying, wow, David Beckham, oh my God, this makes up for the lost Common interview.
Guys, nobody's more sorry and disappointed than I.
I mean, Mabali keeps people, she bumps into people all the time and they say, you really met Common? And she's like, yeah, yeah, of course. And they say, well, prove it. And she goes, oh.
You know how I am with technology.
Shocking. A lot of people loving the Jordan Peterson interview from yesterday. And don't forget, George Meany's popping by just before 8 o'clock to give us a roundup of the world in motoring news. So we'll get to that later too. What else is going on?
Oh, okay, sorry. Trump Jr. and his
remember
wife.
Remember my buddy. Johnston Stewart.
Trump Jr. and his wife are apparently getting a divorce. She filed for divorce after 13 years of marriage. Blah, blah, blah. Okay,
oh,
that's
shame.
Fine.
Have you seen their wedding picture?
No.
She just told everyone your deepest, darkest secret. You must be so embarrassed.
That wedding picture is really quite something.
That wedding picture is enough to see from the very beginning that they were not going to last.
Okay, I need to Google image this thing.
They all look
because...
so miserable.
Oh.
Miserable.
Trump wedding picture.
Yes, because Eric is in it, Ivanka as well. It just, they all look odd. All of them.
Well,
those two children are Trump's, those sons. I mean, that daughter's so lovely, but those two sons are such schmucks.
Who's the guy on the far right?
That's Eric.
Donald Trump Jr. is the one with the dark hair. And Eric
looks like, it looks like what the interns at Madame Tussauds made.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, but I really am trying not to be horrible. It's just matter of fact, he looks like he's missing a chromosome. Like, I don't think he knows where he is. He's just like standing there awkwardly. Yeah, this 13 years.
Yeah, and she's decided to call it quits, filed papers with the court yesterday. She's just not into it anymore.
Right. I hope she gets a settlement like their mother. Well, what's her name? Ivana.
Ivana Trump.
Yeah, I hope she gets a settlement like her.
Yeah, look. She does.
Jitties!
Oh, what?
Sorry, it was Donald Trump. He couldn't help it.
Okay.
No.
You know, it's got to be the weirdest setup, that family. I'm trying to think of how it all works. Because Donald is so into himself. He seems to have, like, he raised these kids to adulthood. I don't think he did it on his own. And obviously, you know, there were nannies and things, but... Like Ivanka, she looks like she's more or less together. She's a good mom. She's married to this Jared Kushner chap, and they've got, two kids, and they seem well-adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I follow her on social media. She posts normal stuff like any other human being, and her dad happens to be president, but he was a rich guy, so she's had a bit of a cushy life. But she seems okay. These two sons, they look like typical spoiled rich kid guys, you know, like East Coast of America, Ivy League,
like
brats.
Paris Hilton's brother,
right? Baron
dipshit.
Yeah,
they never get into trouble because there's always going to be money there to get them out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And they also remember. Don't ever forget. Never forget that these douchebags are the ones who came to South Africa and shot a lion or something.
Yep.
Leopard. I hate them. Those are exactly the kind of people you do not want to end up next to at a dinner party. Just vacuous. They only matter because their daddy matters. I don't like that. They have nothing to contribute to the world. If their dad wasn't Donald Trump, Eric and Don Jr., they wouldn't make a blip on the radar. Am I right?
Sure.
I mean, would have either of them done anything that if the surname Trump wasn't attached to their first name... We would have known about them. There's nothing. They would have disappeared into obscurity.
But that happens a lot, where if you are a wealthy family, you groom your children to take over after you.
I don't even know if he's done that.
No, well, I mean, everything that Trump Jr. and Eric have done would have been related to what their father does.
That's exactly what bothers me. Like Donald, for all the things you say about him, and his dad was rich too, but Donald Trump has made it. I mean, he's a self-made man. You might have been given a lot of cash by your dad in the beginning, but he's really taken it to a new level. The name Trump is on so many buildings. He's built and lost huge amounts of money. He's become president of the United States. Everybody said it was impossible. The guy has done, even if you hate him, you got to acknowledge he's done incredible things. These sons of his done nothing. Nothing. It's totally ridiculous. Anyway, look, I want to talk about something important. We often discuss how we want to be more integrated into the international community here in South Africa. We realize that we've got trade arrangements with certain countries. We've got a tourist situation where we want to bring more people to South Africa. We want to send more South Africans to important parts of the world to be able to establish these trade routes. We know now, and I think the Minister of Tourism now is Derek Honeycomb. One of the things that he said the other day was that he's very, very keen to ramp up trade and tourism to and from South Africa. And one of the good things about this is that certain airlines are standing up and being counted, and they're showing that they have faith in South Africa, and that they're bold and they're proud, and they want to get more people onto planes and traveling between the UK and SA, and that is Virgin Atlantic. And we've been partners with, and we've done a lot of work with Virgin Atlantic over the years. And on the line, we've got Liesel Gericke, who's the head of Middle East and Africa for Virgin Atlantic. Hey, Liesel, how are you? Is Liesel on Skype or on the phone, Sia? All right, on the phone. I'm trying to be professional here, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
You'll get there.
Eventually. Teach me, Mubs. Hey, Liesel, how are you?
Hi, good morning.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm really, really good, thank you. I'm sort of flicking between listening to you online and trying to figure out when I'm being prompted on the phone. So sorry for the bit of a gap there.
No, it wasn't your fault, it was mine. I thought you were on Skype, but you were on the phone. It's not a problem. So listen, Virgin Atlantic have announced a second daily service between Johannesburg and London Heathrow. Now, this is a very big deal because you had one plane that would fly every day, which is a lot of passengers in the first place. You guys are now introducing a second one?
Yeah, so it seems in the world of Virgin Atlantic, this is significant news. And I'll tell you for a couple of reasons why this is so significant. So as you know, Atlantic, the name preempts that we fly predominantly between the UK and then transatlantic into the US. And that's always where our strength has been as an airline.
Right.
And that's where it started 30 odd years ago, now flying 21 years to Johannesburg. And so we fly to a number of other destinations beyond the USA, so from London into either to the east or down into Africa. Mm-hmm. And so Johannesburg will be the first route that we have a double daily on for anything that sits outside of the USA. So that is, as a South African, I'm enormously proud of that.
That's terrific. Is that because of huge demand?
So twofold, really. The one is that the one daily that we have at the moment, and I know that we've partnered and we've worked together with you and the team over the years, is doing exceptionally well. In fact, it's one of the best performing routes in the network. And
yeah,
we can see that there's an enormous amount of opportunity for us to add additional capacity to Johannesburg. And as you well know, the feel in South Africa right now, we opportunity is there. And I think we all feel really optimistic about where things are going as a country. And that was sort of a key part of this decision as well.
All right, so there's a new Boeing 787-9 aircraft that's going to be coming in, and the new flight will add an additional 188,000 seats between Johannesburg and London over a course of a year. That's an incredible number of people we can bring here and send to London.
Yes, so I know that you're a fan of politics, and I know that you probably sat at the edge of your seat when you listened to our new president, Cyril Ramaphosa's State of the Nation address a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that we felt incredibly enthused about was his attitude towards tourism. And one of the things that we actually speak in his speech is that there is no reason why we cannot double the number of tourists to come to South Africa. And he said things like, we live in the most beautiful country in the world. And we can see through cabinet changes and putting Minister Derek Connacht back into the lead of tourism,
right,
that there's this incredible optimism in this industry. And so doubling up aircraft or doubling up the number of seats that we offer on the route,
Liesl, the line is not that great, so I'm not going to keep you on too long, but it's not the end of the world. We can understand the important stuff here. What I love is that the new president, Cyril Ramaphosa, comes in one of his first speeches, he says, let's double the number of tourists. And without missing a beat, Virgin put on an extra flight every day. That's pretty fast activity.
Yes, that's exactly it. So hugely excited about what this means for the country, and it ties right back into, we want to add capacity where it makes sense for the airline, and that's what we've done.
Well, lovely to talk to you, and I hope we'll get to speak to you some more over the next couple of months, but that's really good news. And for anybody who's traveling to or from London to South Africa, this is excellent, excellent news. Thanks, Liesl. Liesl Gerrieke from Virgin Atlantic. No problem. That's great. Now, if you like flying with them, and they're just so cool. I'm not flying with them at the moment. I haven't been on a Virgin flight for a while, but the last time I was on one, they have a bar on board. All the stuff that you like makes flying exciting and fun.
Mm.
It's not this boring humdrum crap of you just go to your seat and you sit there. Man, I've flown a couple of airlines in the last while. You there's nothing to do. You sit there, you're usually wedged between two people you don't know. It can be awful. These guys make flying fun. It's because Branson, he started it. We know Richard Branson. He's a fun dude. Look at the life he leads. He's got this amazing life. He lives on an island and he parachutes and he parasails and he hot air balloons. And it's great. All right, we're going to meet Faye Olubudun, who is the CEO of Insights Publicis in Nigeria. Mubs, you know I'm fascinated with Nigeria. I'm fascinated with the fact that this country has become the leading economy in Africa. And I'm more interested in how we as Africans consume brands. Because I think, and he's written a book, by the way, called The Villager, How Africans Consume Brands. I think we do things differently to the way people in the rest of the world do things. We buy different stuff. We have different patterns of behavior when it comes to buying. In South Africa, I think we're very different to some of the other countries. And I'd like to compare South Africa and Nigeria. And he does that in the book. He also compares Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya in terms of masculinity, long-term orientation, indulgence, individualism, uncertainty avoidance. I mean, these sound like very, very interesting comparisons and the kind of stuff that will make you smart when it comes to understanding the economy of not only the African continent, but the way that we behave with respect to the other parts of the world and the things in the international economy that make us tick.
I mean, it sounds interesting because it also will teach us, one or two things that we didn't know about parts of the continent.
So absolutely. So welcome to the studio, Faye Olubudun. How are you, sir?
Very fine, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You, and congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
It must have been the result of a lot of research.
Yeah, it's a result of years of cumulative 15 years of working, 5 years of speaking and presenting this framework across the world, and one long year of writing.
Well, I mean, you do really give people a lot of insight here into how things are done differently. What would you say are the most startling discoveries that you've made with respect to the way that we in Africa consume brands?
I think it's the fact that how amazing it is that some of the smaller nuances that drive consumption is way beyond functional stuff. I remember a couple of experiences. There's one that was quite striking when I was trying to launch a product for a client years ago. And I was on the research end, and three formulations, we did the product test, and everyone said that the three products were good from a particular part of the country. And I was confused because I'd never seen this before. Like, I knew that the three formulations were different, and we knew the ones that we really wanted to push forward. It was when I recalled that in that particular tribe, they're so diplomatic they never say anything negative.
So they only say positive things.
They
about
only say positive things.
Brands.
So you you need to be really nuanced to know that. That
so what do those people in that tribe do when a product lets them down?
Well, you never know. They just they smile. They say positive things, and then you just see that your sales figures go down.
But it sounds like an incredible way to live. I mean, this just shows you how detailed and narrow the research sometimes has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to market to those people, you really need to know that you're not going to get negative feedback, and you need to be able to almost read that they're being diplomatic when everybody else would say to you, I'm unhappy with this product.
Yeah, yeah, it's so true because in that particular region, you do need to do a lot more qualitative stuff, observations and all of that. What is interesting is that the region on the opposite of that, this is the southwest part of Nigeria. The southeast part of Nigeria, they are very direct. If they don't like something, you know, they
straight
tell
away.
You they're very, you know, they're not as diplomatic as the others. So imagine having to test products and launch products across those regions. You're almost like dealing with two countries.
Everybody always talks about how Africa is the largest opportunity as a marketplace for international brands, for consumer goods, and so on. But very few people have done the research. So your book must be quite seminal in this respect. I remember reading years ago, this must be 10 years or more, a guy read Chika Onyani's Capitalist Nigger, which was a fascinating book. It kind of talked about how African attitudes to consumerism were originally discovered to be very different to the ideas around consumerism anywhere else.
Yeah.
But that's now almost old in terms of, well, it's very old in terms of the kind of qualitative research that he would have done. But I'm interested in what's changing, because if you look at Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya, and you refer to those three countries quite often in your book, there are, first of all, very different patterns between the three.
Mm.
But they've also, over the last 10 years, so much has changed.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, I think that, if I may reframe your question a bit, it's I'd expand it by saying what has changed and what has remained the same.
Okay.
You know, what has changed is obviously we've adopted technology at a rate that has, you know, startled the world. I mean, 10 years ago, there were landlines in Nigeria. Today, there is zero landlines anywhere.
Right.
And the average Nigerian carries two mobile phones all the time. You know, so I mean, absolutely. I mean, I've got two in my pocket. You know, you have to have two mobile phones all the time. That has happened within 10 years. And you've seen young people get very social, even old people. My mom has been chasing me for 6 months to add her on Facebook, which I am not going to do that because I know what will happen, you know.
Yeah, no, she's going to spy on you, everything you do.
But what has remained the same is that beneath all of that, there's certain core elements of our culture that have stayed the same, that hasn't shifted. The Economist magazine conducted some survey across countries recently, mm-hmm. and they were trying to measure cultural flexibility among youths, and they basically targeted 18 to 20-year-olds who were very active on social media. And they found that 18 to 20-year-olds in Nigeria were the most culturally inflexible youths in the world.
Most culturally flexible?
Inflexible.
Oh, inflexible.
Inflexible, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in other words, these are not people who want to change the way that they behave, the way they speak, the way that their traditions have...
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's amazing. I mean, you
is
have
that
this,
a bad thing?
You have these 18 to 20-year-old people saying that it is wrong to have a child before marriage.
Hmm.
Very odd, but they're still the most active on the continent.
Isn't that interesting? Because I mean, Nigeria is one of the most connected countries in Africa, and again, they're exposed to the international world, like, you know, the Gambia or not, for example, or, you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo. But they're inflexible culturally.
Yeah, it was shocking. Even when I read the report and saw the charts, I was quite surprised. And that tells you that there's what is called slow culture and fast culture. You know, the slow culture is about the fundamentals that make us who we are. Those take generations to shift. fast culture is about technology, how we dress, clothes we wear. I mean, 10 years ago, I'd come into this studio wearing a tie and all of that. Today, I'm not yeah. doing that, obviously. But there's still some very deep-rooted cultural values that I don't shift away from. And so many other people don't, because those things are held together by cultural pillars. That's difficult to move a bit, you know. So
you mentioned technology. Has that changed the way that are people buying differently? Are they using technology to help them research stuff before they buy it, to make choices? Are they more particular about what they buy? Because we have had a flood into our markets all over Africa of cheap, nasty goods as well. I mean, as much as there are expensive, well-known international brands, there are also a lot of cheap Hong Kong knockoffs that come in. And it used to be that we were the place that people dumped all that crap.
Yeah. So, you know, it's weird. Looking at the way people buy, it's kind of interesting that people almost always buy now based on the way they've always bought stuff. So we've seen that in Nigeria, that influencer marketing is incredibly on the high rise, and there are a lot of influencers and social media personalities that have built huge businesses and is thriving. And what you find that's driving that, it's actually the cultural value of needing endorsement from a community. So I will buy something because people in my community or my friends say that this is good, or someone that I respect say that this is good. Now, if you go to the West, you find that people will do a lot of research. They will read reviews and compare. Nobody reads reviews in that. We have a joke in Nigeria.
If I said to you, I'm your friend in Nigeria, I said to you that you need to buy this thing, you'd take my word for it.
I'll take your word for it. Or if I saw a product on Instagram, I said, this is nice. I said, who's following this person? Oh, Cliff is. Okay, that means.
So you were saying there was a joke in Nigeria?
So there's a joke in Nigeria that Nigerians don't read terms and conditions. We just agree.
It's a joke here too. We don't. Nobody reads those things.
The fine print. No, yeah. We don't.
You just ask your friend, does this work? He say, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah.
All right, so what about Kenya? Because they've gone through ups and downs. There was this very, very hopeful period where people were saying this is the Silicon Savannah.
Yeah.
This is the place where in Africa technology is going to take a giant leap forward. We had things like M-Pesa, which was a world first. And then it sort of went quiet for a while, and now they're struggling a bit in Kenya.
Well, I think the Kenya's first, the M-Pesa thing took off largely, stuff like that, financial inclusion, took off largely because their government, you know, adjusted their financial regulation to allow telcos to carry financial licenses. This is something that hasn't been done in most other African countries, which is why that particular product hasn't taken off. But if you look at the Kenyans, they're one of the most optimistic people on the planet. You know, they, in spite of everything that is going on, I've never met a sad Kenyan. You know, they're just happy. They always believe that things are going to be better, things will move forward, and so on and so forth. And I'm like, okay, it's not moving forward, but you know, they share that similarity with Nigerians as well. We're incredibly hopeful people. We have a saying in Pidgin, we say it go better, which is just Pidgin for it will be, you know, tomorrow will be better. I mean, my 77 now, when my dad was 72, 5 years ago, he went to the UK and came back and said to me, Feyi, I've seen the world now, I would like to plan my life. I'm like, what are you talking about? You are 72. you can't plan your life. But you know, to him, it was, oh, this is something better is out there. Now I can have some aspirations. And I'm looking at this man, you are 72. Why? What are you thinking about? But that's the spirit of the average Nigerian. The Kenyans also have that same spirit. What it gives them is huge resilience. You know, which can have good and bad.
No, I prefer that to what is the overwhelming feeling in South Africa, which is not like that. South Africans are not optimistic. They're not seeking opportunities like people in Nigeria and Kenya do. And I often draw this contrast because South Africans get, I think, a lot of deserved criticism from the rest of the continent for thinking that they're better and thinking that, you know, we're the leading country in Africa. And we know already that our market is lagging behind Nigeria's now in terms of, and certainly with growth, there are a number of African countries outperforming us. But South Africa is not like that. In your research, does that also show that South Africa's changing as a market?
So I think part of what's driving that is that you find that South Africa is when you think of sub-Saharan African culture, South Africa actually doesn't fall into that, because South Africa is composed of two cultures. You have the Anglo-Dutch culture, which is a very Western culture by orientation. It's individualistic, it's slightly on the pessimistic side because it's based on numbers and projections and all of that. And then you have the African Ubuntu culture, which is more community-based and so on. And when you combine those two cultures in a country that has the level of infrastructural development that is here, it's difficult for you to begin to have national sentiments like optimism and so on and so forth. And you also find that the culture is very quantitative, not qualitative. So yesterday I was with a friend. I was supposed to have an event at Impelo yesterday evening, and then we got a text that the event had been cancelled because it was power outage. So I laughed and I told my friends in Nigeria, I said, well, I was, since 2016 I've been experiencing power outages in South Africa. I said, just by generating sets. So I told him, I said, it's because it's a quantitative culture. Somebody is sitting somewhere and is waiting for it to get to 35% incidence, and then they'll do something. I said, but in Nigeria, it's qualitative. It happens once, twice. We have a proverb that says that if a tree is going to poke your eye from a distance, you dodge it before it happens. So I said, by now, we'd have generating sets everywhere and we'll move on. And you see that... That yeah. cultural contrast translating into how things are done.
And a lot of people in our country, because of this, maybe you're absolutely hitting the nail on the head here. I mean, I don't doubt it for a second if you've done the research. But maybe we also sit on our hands a lot and expect things to be done for us. Where in places like Nigeria and Kenya, if you don't do it yourself, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, in Nigeria, we consider ourselves to be our own local government. Because nothing happens, you know.
Nothing. I mean, rely on
the
house.
That sounds so nice.
It's not nice in reality. It's expensive.
That sounds so freeing.
But you have to look to
it
yourself.
Yeah.
You have to look to. I mean, in my house, I've got inverter. I've got a generating set because most of the time, like every Nigerian, you have to generate your own power. You have to
water.
Do a lot of things. Water. You do the same thing for yourself, and all of that, which is a bit of a contradiction, because it's a country that the locus of control is external. There's a lot of reliance on community. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to certain things, you provide for yourself. If you flip that to a country like South Africa that has higher internal locus of control, you also find a paradox of, in spite of that, some things are not, people are not doing some things for themselves. So there's a nice tension in there.
Well, I'm fascinated. I mean, the reason you call it the villager is because that's the mindset of the average African consumer, according to your research. So just explain to us what it means to be a villager.
So, you know, being a villager means it's from the idea that almost everyone leaves the rural area and comes to the cities. And if you look at the layout of Africa, it's not like the West, where every state or city is developed enough for someone to stay where they are. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for economic prosperity, you've got to move. However, when you move, what then happens is you're carrying with you the dreams of everyone in the village, because remember, it's a community-based system. Mm-hmm. And as such, in order for you to retain your identity in the city, you have to keep some of the cultural components that make up who you are in the village. And so I say that the African consumer is a villager, and that the village is not a physical place. It's a psychological construct that's got eight components, which I articulate in detail in the book. And that even though the man is in the city, is pursuing economic prosperity, what drives how he engages internally and what he consumes and the things he does, the products he uses and so on and so forth, is actually coming from values that are rooted in the village.
That makes a lot of sense. But there are obviously positives and negatives to that.
True.
The negative, the obvious thing to concern anybody if you find yourself trapped in this situation, is that it creates some internal conflict.
It does.
Like you're removed from the village, but you're still required to be in it. It's almost like you're expected to be everything.
Yeah, it does. But you know, it's kind of easy to live with, because the community is organized in a way that ensures that you live that way. So, for instance, I talk about, you know, things like community affirmation, community sanctions. There's some things that you just can't do. So, for instance, in most parts of Africa, at least in Nigeria, Kenya, and all of that, if you have a child, you can't name your child. It has to be named by the larger community, your parents, aunties, and so on and so forth. Well, you can go and live in the city all you want. The day your wife delivers a baby, your mom is going to show up, your dad will follow the, you know, and they'll come with names. So you simply can't do it. You see what I mean?
Mm.
So because those structures are there, it sort of makes it easy to do. And also because it's when you're in the city, everyone else around you is also a villager. They also have their own cultural values that they are projecting within the city. So it's sort of like a weird self-reinforcing system. Now, the other side to it is, in a world that is getting increasingly globalized, and the world is getting smaller, and, you know, what then happens is that people begin to look for identity because everything is right. The same. You know, I get bored on social media sometimes because once people take a picture, the same posture in the picture, everybody does it.
Yeah.
Everybody uses the same filter. So people are looking for differences. And what's happening is that people are then going back to their cultural identity to find out what makes them different in a world that is very, very globalized, you know.
Was there anything in your research that really surprised you as much as, say, the situation with culture in Nigeria, where it's the least flexible? Was there other stuff that surprised you that you weren't expecting?
So I was surprised by the, you know, one of the eight components I talk about is the value of the enemy. And I talk about the fact that that the African is motivated by an enemy. His psychology of success must include an enemy. And initially, when I started researching this, I first began to notice it in music. And found out that all the successful musicians always had what I called an anti-hater track on their albums. And,
right.
And that was like the club banger and all of that. But as I began to research this, I was surprised to come across Western research that actually confirmed that and said that Maslow's hierarchy of human needs does not apply to Africa. It's a Western construct. And that the whole idea of pursuing self-actualization is a Western thing. And that cultures like Africa and Asia, people aren't pursuing self-actualization. They're actually pursuing the goal of fulfilling the role that the community has assigned to them. So I was quite struck by that. I didn't believe that I would find research that supported that, particularly from
this thing.
The West.
This thing about needing an enemy.
Yes,
I mean that's incredible because that will inform a lot of the behavior.
Yeah, it does.
If you need an enemy in order to, and if you need to vanquish that enemy in order to succeed,
yeah,
then a lot of people are battling demons that we need to acknowledge.
You know, the concept of enemy for the African is not necessarily an antagonist. This is not Al-Qaeda type of
no, but it's winning. It's about
winning.
Winning is predicated upon you beating someone else.
Yeah, that enemy is the person that says that
you
stands
win.
Yeah, that says you won't win, and that's the person you need to. So your psychology of success is kind of like a triangle. On one hand is your own individual aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand is what the community expects you to become. And then, you know, the third leg of it is proving the enemy wrong that you can do this. And yesterday I went 2 days ago I went to barb my hair. Somewhere in Joburg, and wonderful Baba Congolese guy, name is Sammy. And you know, Babas give you good stories and all of that. Tells me this incredible story of his life, how he was impacted by a Nigerian, a South African, and an American, and all of that. Nice story. And at the end, he says to me, he said, you know, yo, brah, you know, if you want to achieve something in life, there's always an enemy there. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I wrote a chapter on it in my book. And I was so struck by that this is a Congolese guy. He's been in South Africa for 11 years. He's been influenced by multiple people, but he's there babbling in a salon, and he has this mindset that there's an enemy I need to prove wrong, even though I'm just a babbler.
That can be very motivating, but it can also be a little disempowering, I would imagine, because sometimes there aren't people actively conspiring against you, and if you don't have them and you have that mindset, you need to create them.
Yeah, I mean, it can go to that extent, to be honest, but almost always there is, because if you look at the group dynamics of the African setting and the fact that we're very collectivist, almost always if you have aspirations, you share that within the context of a group, and there will always be someone there who has a different point of view, what we will call the devil's advocate. Well, that person may ultimately actually in your mind be labeled as an enemy, because right. you look forward to the day you come back successful at that thing that the person said you couldn't be, and you let them know that you're successful. And
it can motivate you.
It can motivate you, yeah. It can motivate you.
Is this collectivism at odds with capitalism?
I think it is. It's an interesting question for you to ask, because it's something I've been thinking about, even though I didn't touch on it in the book. I think it is, because capitalism is strongly rooted in an individualistic culture.
Mm.
And you can see that Africa as a whole is struggling with capitalism. You know, in businesses that have gone very, very capitalist, we've seen struggles with succession planning, we've seen struggles with multi-generational businesses and all of that. And I would almost endeavor to argue that somehow Africa needs to find a business model or a business philosophy that sits well within the collectivist culture that makes us who we are, and that perhaps will offer a way forward.
If that's the case, then there's obviously a deeper question that can be asked here is about individual agency.
Mm.
I mean, the ability for someone you mentioned earlier to be able to choose not to take on the role that their village has assigned to them.
Yeah.
That they don't necessarily have to choose to be what their community tells them to be.
Yeah.
It almost feels like that goes against, you know, the Enlightenment principles of individual liberty and agency.
Well, so
is that a conflict?
There's a conflict, but there's a nice resolution to it. If you do exercise agency, which you can, and say, okay, I don't want to be whatever my community wants me to be, well, you have to come back successful. That's right. that's the balance.
And if you don't succeed, the community will eat you up.
Yeah, that's
so. It's almost as if there's a higher price to pay.
Yeah.
For Africans.
Yeah.
If you fail.
Yeah.
And the price is that you not only will fail in the market, but you will fail with your community.
Yeah. You know,
that seems really unfair.
Well, you know, most collectivist cultures are shame-based cultures.
Jesus, that's awful.
You know, individualistic cultures are guilt-based, and you know, guilt is
both are awful. But I mean, shame-based. Shame-based means you have to walk down the street in your own town and have people speaking ill of you.
Yeah, I mean, and you see, it's guilt you can just
write off if you have no conscience.
Well, you know, the thing with shame-based cultures is one of the benefits of it is it does create social regulation. Because the avoidance of shame can be a very strong motivation in itself. You don't, you know, you find entrepreneurs all over the place. I see them in Nigeria who wanted to do something else, but couldn't do it or follow their dream or whatever. They know they have to succeed, you know.
You mentioned the price of failure
mm-hmm.
being so high, but the benefits of success are tremendous as well.
Yes.
So you have this much more extenuated and differentiated situation. So if you fail and then you end up being shamed and your community will reject you very often and say, well, we told you so.
Yeah.
And those enemies in inverted commas will stand on you and make you feel small.
Yeah.
But the value of success is enormous, because it is. There's this attribution of almost superpower.
Yeah, I mean, I touched on this briefly in the book, but my own personal story almost follows that exactly. You know, I was supposed to be a medical doctor. I was in medical school for 4 years. You know, my dad was very proud. And then, you know, I didn't pass the exams and I had to leave. And the man was upset. He didn't speak to me for 4 years, was just mad all over the place. You know, and then I told him I was going to read psychology. He said, so you are going to be talking to mad people. And, you know, so you can imagine this disaster. My mom was crying every day. Just say, you were supposed to be a medical doctor, great professional. You'll be talking to mad people. And I had to explain to her, no, it's not talking to mad people. I said, no, you know. And then fast forward years later, became the CEO of the leading ad agency in the country, drives it, you know, had a Mercedes Benz and all of that. You know, you can imagine the emotion taking going home with the car. We do this thing in Nigeria where you have to bless your car when you buy it and all of that, you know. And the kind of prayers my parents were saying when they were blessing the car was kind of gratifying, because, you know, to them it was. And, you know, my dad actually said, well, all those enemies that said you couldn't succeed, now they can see that you've succeeded. So you see that dynamic.
Did you say to your dad, yeah, you were once an enemy when you said that I was going to work with mad people?
That would have been a very tough conversation.
Faye, this is a really, really interesting book. I would encourage anybody who says that they are, you know, you hear about all these companies all over the world that are interested in understanding the African market, how they can make an impact, how they can start selling their products, how they can introduce themselves to African consumers. I think this is going to be required reading for those people. This should be a textbook in economy, in, you know, lectures in economics at university. It's terrific. The Villager is what it's called, How Africans Consume Brands. Faye Olubudan, I appreciate you coming to speak to us this morning.
Thank you very much, Cliff.
And I hope we'll see you again soon. You spend a lot of time in South Africa?
I go back and forth, so yeah.
Yeah. That's another thing, huh? You have to constantly be moving in Africa. You can't ever settle down and just do nothing.
So true. So true.
Man, this is very cool. Yeah. I appreciate you coming in to speak to us.
Thank you very
Thanks
much. Thanks
so much
for having me.
All right. Pleasure. Yes. There we go. You can get the book, The Villager, How Africans Consume Brands. It's very, very interesting. I breezed through it during the last 3 or 4 days and found it to be just, you know, very seminal. It's helped me to understand kind of how a lot of things that I wasn't making sense of, and you just heard from Faye, things like, you know, this idea of community, the idea of collectivist thinking, the idea of if this is competitive with and in conflict with capitalism, how do you deal with a marketplace that is essentially based on, you know, trade, supply and demand, which is capitalism? And it's complicated because sometimes you end up trying to square the circle or trying to contort yourself into the most awkward and uncomfortable positions in order to accommodate ideas that are actually opposed. They're polar opposites. Let's get into some updates on the week in, among other things, motoring. George Meany's here. Hey, George, the CEO of Auto Trader.
How's it, Gareth?
How are you?
Hey, Ben, my buddy.
Look at that. Hey. He's become a real radio voice. Did you hear that now? Yeah, he's very...
He's here a lot, Gareth.
Yeah,
I know.
He's been doing the show so long now that he can speak like he's been on radio for a number of years. Now, it sounds good. What's up, George?
So, everybody in this room probably understands what the K53 is.
That's the driver's license.
Yes.
And it's knowing that you must check your rearview mirror and check your side mirror and turn this...
Yeah, all of that stuff. Well,
bullshit.
Government wants to ditch it.
Oh! What are we going to go for?
So they want to introduce, there's a transport policy on the table at the moment, published on the 5th of March, where the government wants to introduce to schools a train-the-trainer scenario where individual teachers begin to teach driving as part of the curriculum.
Well,
no, there's 12.5 million learners in the country, so this should
sense.
Be an interesting thing, but makes sense because the Road Traffic Infringement Agency and the Department of Basic Education have now partnered to help ditch the K53 and bring about the school curriculum that allows learners in schools to learn to drive.
Is that what they do in America?
I think schools, I mean, I'm not entirely sure, but I think schools in the later years have some sort of driver program.
Yeah.
You know, maybe this mimics that. I'll go and read up on it.
I'm worried because the basic education department can't get anything right. How are they going to get that? We're going to have worse drivers on our road if Angie Mocheja's people are the ones who are going to make sure that this happens or doesn't happen. I mean, I'm terrified of this outcome.
Well, I mean...
The more control you give to the Department of Education... I mean, look, I don't know who's worse, the Department of Education or the Department of Transport. Take your pick.
Well, I think it's a good effort, but I mean, as we've seen, it's very difficult to police the stuff that the government brings about. You know, if anything, they should rather be, and we've been banging on about this in the Auto Central show for months, is visible policing does more than anything else. Just put policemen on the road and make people crap themselves if they're going to cross the line.
Yeah,
and K53 is a structure, so
yeah, you don't throw something out unless you absolutely know what you're going to put in is better.
Yeah,
otherwise you're asking for trouble, and we do not need more bad drivers on our roads. And I speak as a bad driver.
Well, one of the things in this policy document is they also want to relook at reevaluating drivers when you renew your license.
Yeah,
which I think is a good thing.
I don't see a problem with that, because you know, especially like old people, they think they can drive forever.
Yeah,
and then they end up, you know, they end up causing huge trouble because they're 99 years old and all they do is go and renew their license without retesting.
No, I absolutely agree. My grandmother's a prime example. Her license should have been taken away. I love her too. But a long time ago, but she had a car accident on the highway was in a back brace for about 6 months.
Oh, God, yeah. You don't need that.
You know, I think, I don't know if this is going to help the situation, but... you know, let's see what happens.
Interesting stuff.
Let's see what happens.
Okay.
Then, you know, Elon Musk. Everybody knows Elon Musk. We all love Elon Musk to bits because he's South African. But,
well, he doesn't care about South Africa.
Yeah. I've never seen him tweet anything about South Africa. I wish he would.
He's not proud of being... And we've got to stop thinking that everyone else who's born here cares about it. He's no Charlize Theron. If you ask him about South Africa, he changes the subject. He doesn't like this place. He doesn't like what it did. He was bullied at school. Think South Africans are douchebags, and that's why he got out of here as quickly as he could.
Well, I wish he would change that sentiment. Well, but anyway, he runs Tesla and SpaceX, and then he's got a third company called The Boring Company.
Yes.
That bores holes.
That's right. They're building tunnels.
And this boring company had an initiative that was supposed to, well, it is, boring tunnels underneath cities for cars to almost act like a lift and then travel at high speed on these platforms between cities.
Right, it would
cities.
Alleviate traffic, it would make traveling faster. I mean, basically, you'd get on the platform, you wouldn't have to drive, the platform would move at a very fast speed between San Francisco and L.A.,
yeah,
and you'd be able to cover a distance that would normally on the road and with traffic take you 2-3 hours, and you could do it in 40 minutes.
Yes, at 250 kilometers per hour. Now, that initiative was aimed at current road users or current drivers and not at pedestrians and cyclists. So they've changed this strategy to focus on pedestrians and cyclists. Where the car won't be lowered into the tunnel, but now they've actually got... buses or platforms that can take pedestrians and cyclists.
Cyclists and buses, two of the things. If we could just get rid of them, we'd make the world better. Buses.
You know that the Geneva Motor Show is on the go at the moment.
Yes, tell me about that, because that you've been there a couple of times, right?
Well, no, I haven't actually been to the Geneva Motor Show.
I thought you went to these things all the time.
Not to the Geneva. I go to the other stuff.
So what do they unveil in Geneva?
A lot of concept stuff, and that's probably why it doesn't really... I mean, I don't like concept stuff, because a lot of it doesn't come to market, and, you know...
Classic car tease.
Yeah.
It's
not, you know, I mean, it's great and I follow it, but it's a lot of concept stuff. So it's on until the 18th of March, but what they have... at the Geneva Motor Show at the moment is the first production road and air legal flying car.
Yay!
Looks like that.
Oh, I've wanted one of those for the longest time. Is that, who's that, developed by Müller?
This podcast isn't ending anytime soon.
So
this is Gareth's favorite thing in the whole world.
It's developed by a Dutch company called PAL-V.
Okay.
And it's not too far-fetched. As a matter of fact, it's actually out there. And the reason why it's not too far-fetched is because it contains two motors. It contains a regular car motor, and it contains a Rotax engine, which is currently in airplanes at the moment, in light aircraft. Hmm. And it acts like a gyrocopter. Are you familiar with gyrocopters?
Yes, gyros. A very, very interesting way to travel.
Very interesting way to travel. So what this
little... It's sort of like a little light helicopter.
Yes.
You don't even have a cockpit. It's just kind of you're exposed.
And the way a gyrocopter works, it's constantly in what's called auto-rotate mode, which a helicopter has to get into if the engine fails, whereas gyrocopter is constantly in auto-rotate mode. And these propellers fold back. And the propeller that propels you forward is folded in. And if you want to turn it into a flying machine, you have to get out and extend these.
So in other
words,
it wouldn't help you on the N1 in bumper-to-bumper traffic.
No.
But it does also sound ungainly. It sounds like it looks shit.
Well, yeah, well.
It doesn't look great.
It doesn't look great. It's not aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, I mean, you want something so high tech that these rotors pop out and automatically, you know, you want it to be really, really smart so you don't have to be embarrassed.
Exactly. Now, this thing looks a bit ugly.
If you flew this around, you'd be embarrassed.
It's called the Liberty, which isn't an exactly exciting name either.
No. All right, but at least they're making some progress.
They are.
I'm excited about this.
And then lastly, at the Geneva Motor Show as well, is Goodyear's concept oxygen tire.
Wow.
Which takes moss.
Yeah.
And the moss is a living organism inside the tire, absorbs CO2 and puts out oxygen.
Really?
And this has already apparently been tested.
Without light?
It is genetically hacked.
Oh, okay.
So, the University of Georgia has demonstrated that this actually works. So they say if Paris had these tires on all of their cars, it would remove 4,000 tons of CO2 each year out of the atmosphere.
I'm all for it. Who would be against it?
Exactly, because even electric cars have to have tires.
I like that very much.
And that's it for the week, Gareth.
Thank you, George. Always nice to see you on a Friday because it means the weekend is here and you always give us some useful and interesting info. And you can catch all the more of this, if you like it, on Auto Central, which is live Monday morning at 10 o'clock. Yeah, 10 o'clock. All right, so don't miss that. That's with George Meany and the rest of the team, Chad and everybody else, because you often have guests in there as well. Tyron's there. It's a party. If you care about motoring, if you care about cars, if you care about our roads in South Africa and all the stories that affect you, then you need to go and listen to that show. And download the podcast and you can hear all the previous shows. They're all evergreen because the kind of things that they're talking about are things that are very much in our daily lives. So go and listen to Auto Central, and thank you to George Meany, the CEO of Auto Trader. By the way, if you haven't already got a pair of our Cliff Central unwired earphones, you need to get them ASAP. We've created them specially for you. They connect to any smartphone or any laptop or any other kind of tablet. You can listen to podcasts, music, videos, even phone calls with over 10 hours of battery life and a built-in microphone, a 3-button controller, and ergonomic design. It is the best you can get at the price of just 550 Rand. Discover more by visiting cliffcentral.com. You will not be sorry. You can say thank you afterwards, but in the meantime, try it out and let me know what you think. So far, we're getting some nice reviews. We got a great review from Stuff Magazine just the other day. Okay, time to check in on the unnews for this morning. This is the stuff that you're going to be forced to talk about at work today, so you might as well make it interesting. Okay, where do we begin? Well, a large amount of gold and silver bars have fallen out of a Russian plane on takeoff at a remote location. Local authorities say the situation was quickly resolved, and Vladimir Putin isn't that upset about it. He is looking for a new crew to fly planes from Siberian mines to the rest of Europe, though. Steve Hoffmeyer has been told he no longer is welcome to perform in the town hall of George. The local municipality says it isn't because he attracts so much negative press around racism, it's because he just pumps so many women at those performances. Last year, the cleaning staff were busy for days in the backstage area after the event, and they don't want to go through that again or even talk about it. And finally, Dali Mpofu will be representing Kagiso Rabada in his appeal against the ICC's latest ruling. Rabada has been banned for 2 games, but Mpofu believes that he can get this overturned, plus makes live test cricket free for all and expropriates various ICC properties without compensation. It's very exciting. That's combining Dali's roles, you see, in the EFF and as an advocate. All right, we're going to give you an insight into the life of Gareth Soldier Boy McClellan, who joined us in studio to talk about his life, being bullied by his sisters to becoming South Africa's only fighter in the UFC. You could learn about what makes this bearded champion tick. That's coming up next. CliffCentral.com. I hope you're having an excellent start to your weekend. It begins right here. Get into it. All right?
This is CliffCentral.com.